Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My colleague and co-host Sam is off today. The 25th Amendment has become a very hot topic of late. It's even now being discussed on television shows such as Homeland. During those moments when President Trump's presidency seemed to be most unstable, discussions have emerged about what this amendment is, how it works. Many people have never even heard about the different parts of it, and whether it would provide some kind of path, in this case or others, without the impeachment process or resignation toward the removal of the president. But most important, it has re-entered our national conversation. It's a complicated process. It's a long haul, as we will learn today, but it is now something we all need to consider and understand. Today, our guest to discuss this is Harold Koh, who's the Sterling Professor of International Law at the Yale Law School. He returned there after serving as a legal advisor to the U.S. Department of State. He's one of the leading experts in the country on public and private international law, national security law, and human rights. He has worked in many different areas. He's published extensively. And today we were hoping to have him on so that he could discuss a new publication and study he's been involved with through the Yale Law School Rule of Law Clinic, which is called The 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution, A Reader's Guide, which is a fascinating nonpartisan look at how this would all work. So, Professor Koh, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. Maybe we can just start by having you tell us a little more about what the 25th Amendment is, why we have it, and what its origins are.
Well, the 25th Amendment was adopted in 1967. As you recall, this was after the Kennedy assassination. There had been a number of circumstances in past presidencies, including Madison, Tyler, Garfield, and Woodrow Wilson, and up through Eisenhower, where the president was incapacitated for some period of time. And senators and other lawyers realized that there was no mechanism to address this issue. So there was extensive congressional discussion and debate, and the net result was the 25th Amendment. One part of it, Section 3, allows the president to temporarily designate the vice president as acting president if he does something like undergo anesthesia, and that's happened on a number of occasions. For example, when Ronald Reagan was almost assassinated and had to go under surgery, or also when George W. Bush had a colonoscopy. But the part that's the most interesting is Section 4, which has never been invoked. What if the president is unfit to discharge the powers and duties of his office? Can the vice president, acting with members of the cabinet, have him temporarily removed? And when this issue arose, I first saw it on television. I went and looked at the provision, and I suddenly realized that the timetables were incredibly fast, that if an initial determination is made and sent over, the vice president can immediately become acting president, and the president is removed from office that day. And then there are a period in which they determine whether that will stay in force. And if the president objects, which is possible, and in fact, in some circumstances, likely, Congress has 21 days to decide whether they agree that the president is unable, which they have to vote on by a vote of 2/3. So the whole process takes place in less than a month. And when you think about it, our government doesn't move that fast. And it suddenly occurred to me that we could have a situation where this thing is triggered, and then suddenly a whole bunch of instant experts are on cable TV expressing their views about what this means without ever having read it, never having looked at the legislative history, taking things out of context, or worst of all, doing something because of their political bias. The net result of it was that we did this study, and we think it's a very careful, thorough, and detailed account of everything. Every question you might possibly have about how the 25th Amendment ought to operate.
And just to clarify, in terms of why Section 4 was put in there, Do we have a good sense of the intention or the concern that process was adopted, why it was adopted?
Yeah, I think it was very much a function of the fact that you could have a president who's not aware that they're unable to function. A well-known case, of course, that came up after the amendment was Richard Nixon. At the end of his time in office, as Kissinger has reported, he often fell to drinking. He was depressed. He talked to people who weren't there. He didn't sleep. And while he was subjected to an impeachment process, this option was never fully discussed or explored, it seems to me. Another occasion where this apparently arose was in the late part of Ronald Reagan's term, where he appeared to be suffering from the early stages of Alzheimer's. Howard Baker, the former senator, became his chief of staff. And according to a number of accounts, they brought in people to observe him with the possibility of triggering Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. But on that particular day, Reagan appeared so hearty and robust that they just let it go. And he was only a year away from leaving office anyway.
And how does the initial determination, what does that mean? How is there any guidance on how that's made? What did you find when you were looking at it in terms of your sense of how that should be made? How does the cabinet make an evaluation of whether this process should be started?
Well, let me say first, there are two ways to trigger it, each of which the vice president must be involved. It could be the vice president and a majority of what is called the principal officers. It's not even the cabinet. So one television show improperly said the cabinet. In fact, the executive departments, which is a category created by law, there must be eight people. So essentially, the vice president and eight cabinet members can trigger it. Now, there's a possibility, for example, that the president could threaten the cabinet, or another way they would be disabled from operating. So the second mechanism was created, which is something called the, quote, other body. Congress could, by statute, create a different body, which would, by a majority, make that same determination. Either way, the vice president's vote is critical. But I think the most important question, Julian, and the one that you've correctly focused on, is the word is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office. Now, obviously, that most invokes physical incapacitation. You know, for example, if the president is unconscious. Mm-hmm. It could also encompass a mental incapacitation if the president is delusionary. But it doesn't preclude the possibility of, say, the president having a conflict of interest, or, you know, being kidnapped, or a family member of his being kidnapped. He could be in good health, but still be unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office because of some conflict of interest. There's always the possibility and concern, for example, that the president might block medical people from coming in to look at him, and or make self-serving medical evaluations. So the most important finding, I think, of the report is that inability is a political determination to be made by these political actors. It's not a medical determination. They can obviously get, and probably should get, medical input, but that is not itself determinative.
So it seems, just from listening to you, that the initial part of this is incredibly fraught and uncertain, with a lot of room for subjectivity. And so thinking of that in our very polarized world probably raises, it certainly raises concerns, but it probably makes it, in the minds of many politicians, prohibitive. It's really a last resort, because although the president and the Congress have checks afterwards, the process could be triggered for all sorts of reasons justified on this kind of allegation of incapacity.
Well, you know, there have been a couple of books written recently about the impeachment process, which is much discussed. But as everybody knows, the impeachment process requires both houses of Congress to act, and for there both to be indictment and then a trial, which we all, you know, observed about 20 years ago.
Right.
In the case of the 25th Amendment, the president can be removed on that day by the vote of nine people. And that's much less difficult to gather. Now, at that point, it only triggers a process where Congress has to confirm the removal, but the status quo could change extremely quickly. And because of this option, there can be a lot of political bargaining around this legal possibility. I'm not here to advertise for any television show, and I don't want to give any spoiler, but in at least one of the programs, the vice president went to the president and announced that he had the votes. And if the president didn't change certain policies, would send the letter. And you can imagine that kind of thing happening. This also then raises the possibility that the president could fire the cabinet members or the principal officers, as they're called in the amendment. And the question is, if that happened, would that be impeachable conduct? In the television show I'm referring to, there was a ludicrous point at which they announced they would sort of petition directly to the Supreme Court, which seems extremely unlikely under the circumstances. But it just shows you that there would be a million questions that would have to be answered very, very quickly. And somebody should, you know, we thought, and I'm talking about 9 wonderful law students and 4 other faculty members here. Somebody should, in the calm light of day, read everything there is, because this is one of those constitutional provisions where it really is possible to read everything that has been written and put our best view of all of these issues, big and small, into one place for kind of a one-stop shop.
And if the president challenges this and then it's in Congress's hands, how does Congress make, what's the process through which Congress has to then make a decision, through committee, through the whole? How does that actually work? What would we be watching?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question, because that's another reason to have our report. There are no standing procedures. You know, our Congress is entirely unprepared for this moment, as far as I can tell. Now, one member of Congress, Jamin Raskin of Maryland, formerly a professor at American University Law School, proposed a statute to create the alternative body, the other body that's mentioned in the amendment, but it hasn't been voted on. But what I think is a more urgent priority is that there be standing procedures. You know, who would be the committees of jurisdiction? How would this be managed as a congressional matter? How would they make sure that the votes got done in time? You know, what if it turned out that one of the key figures, the speaker or the president pro tem, was vacant because of a resignation? Now, it's not vacant now, but our speaker has announced that he's not going to stand again. And so you would have a few lawyers in the Congress trying to read this amendment and trying to figure out what's going on. And we thought, to go through all the legislative history and all the subsequent discussion would take a huge amount of effort. So we thought best to distill it in one place. And it's in a kind of question and answer form. We answered every question that we could. Some were extremely clear. You know, for example, do the word days mean calendar days, or does it mean business days? You know, so it says 21 days for Congress to decide whether someone's unable. That suggests calendar days, you know, 7 days in a week, 3 weeks. But we wanted to check. So we went back and looked, and we went and got confirmation from the greatest experts of the time. One person who is de facto the author of the 25th Amendment is John Furyk, former dean of Fordham Law School and former president of the Association of the Bar of the City of New York. Another person who's looked at it is Birch Bayh, former senator who was one of the key drafters. And we not only went through everything that they had written, but we also asked for their views. And they've said, basically, with, in the case of John Furyk, many, many comments, that this is the best reader's guide that they have seen.
It seems that when this was put into place, and talking about Birch Bayh is a good reminder of the era, it really was in the aftermath of a period of assassinations, kind of physical threats to political leaders, and that kind of instability. Whereas today it's being brought up in a very different context, which is really about a particular president and dealing with what some argue is a mental instability or mental inability to lead. And so this kind of a Byzantine process in some ways that you've outlined, or process full of ambiguities, might be applied, if it was applied, for very different reasons or in a very different context than when this was all put together.
Well, I think, Julian, the technology has changed many things. First of all, it's much harder to hide what's actually going on. You know, a number of the presidents of the 19th century, as you know, were sick for a long time, and their spouses essentially acted as de facto president. The vice presidents are normally reluctant to act for fear of looking like they're trying to seize power. We now have a situation where a lot of things could come together all at once. So, for example, suppose there is some kind of threat and the president were hustled into a bunker and then the communications failed. The president could be in perfect health, but he's essentially incapacitated from receiving the necessary information. I think people would clearly say at that point he's unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office. Now, if that could be quickly repaired, that's one thing. But, you know, what if you had a combination of factors which made it the president unable to discharge those powers and duties? In another one of the dramatic representations, you know, the president's daughter is kidnapped. So he's in perfect shape, but obviously his judgment is affected by this kind of personal situation. So you would need to get people to focus on this question immediately and make sure that somebody is, in fact, able to act. And then a further question would be, at the moment the vice president triggers this with the support of either 8 members or principal officers or a majority of this other body that might be created, the entire apparatus of the government goes to work for the acting president. And then the president responds with whatever capacities or resources he or she is able to muster.
So this period between the acting president taking power and the president responding, if it's not immediate, would really but it's anticipated, would really almost paralyze government officials in terms of waiting to see what's going on.
Yeah, the best way to think of it is 4, 2, and 21. What triggers this is the initial declaration. The vice president and, let's say, 8 cabinet members send a letter to the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem saying that the president is unable to discharge his duties. Then the question is, does the president agree? And say the president contests in that first 4 days, then the Congress is summoned.
How does he protest, or she protest? Would send a letter?
Yeah, send a letter saying, I'm not unable. The first letter would say, you are unable. And then the provision, Section 4, gives Congress 48 hours to assemble. And, you know, people could be coming from Hawaii and Alaska and things like that. And then once they're in session, and then they have to vote 21 days after that, 21 calendar days after that. And they have to vote by 2/3 as to whether to confirm the idea that the president is unable. Now, if they do, then the vice president continues to function as acting president. And interestingly, the amendment says then absolutely nothing about how another vice president is then selected. In fact, you're then in a period where you have a president who has been found unable and in fact continues to be called president, an acting president who is actually functioning, and then a vice presidential position, which is in effect vacant. And so one of the questions we look at is whether the vice president could still preside over the Senate on a tie vote as acting president. And that's the kind of question that might come up at that point and that people would need to think about. Now, obviously, our answers on all of these are just our best evaluation, but we've looked at every source that is available so that instead of just spitballing, we're giving what we think people would find if they did the research themselves on a very close basis.
And one last procedural question, that if the president's declaration, I'm fit, ignore the last letter you received, is rejected by Congress, that's it. The president is out of power. There's no more recourse for the president at that point.
That's right. But notice this. It's asymmetric. Suppose they got to just shy of 2/3 votes in both houses and he resumes office, he could then fire the entire cabinet. And And they could try again. Say there was a intervening midterm election. They can try as many times as they want. Meanwhile, all of the things going on could be taken into account as high crimes or misdemeanors that would be relevant for a process of impeachment that comes along at the same time. So there are endless possibilities. And the main thing is that the timetable is so fast and so rigid, people will really want to know what the answers to this question are.
Right. So it's probably, I assume the speed in part is intended so this isn't drawn out, and that if this is ever triggered, it's only triggered after, at least ideally, there's a very clear determination that this is necessary, rather than just haphazardly sent to Congress, let's change presidents. But at the same time, the speed allows very little room or time for deliberation after it starts, or evaluation of the concerns raised from the initial letter. So I guess it's a double-edged sword in terms of how fast this works.
Yes, it can work quite easily if it's manifestly clear. The president is entirely forgetful and isn't aware of this, or is suffering some side effect of some physical ailment, but isn't able to appreciate its impact on his or her judgment. But in close questions, or where there's a combination of factors, it could be a very wild couple of weeks.
And I know the part of the study was really to outline how this works, but just in terms of the process, do you think it's a good process? Do you think overall it has a logic, it would work if necessary, or did you find parts of it that you think would are problematic?
It does have a logic. It was well thought through, and it's been constantly reviewed. So, for example, there were two major studies, one by the Miller Commission in University of Virginia. One of their recommendations was that if Congress were to create another body, it should not include judges. This should be executive branch officials, legislators. One question is, should doctors be on? And if so, what should be their qualifications? The other study which was done is that John Furyk, one of the key original drafters, had his students look at this on the 50th anniversary. They convened a series of conferences and symposia where a whole bunch of different questions were reviewed, and then they issued a report which summarized what they thought were the best findings. And they noted some very significant oversights. For example, the fact that there's no provision as to what should happen to who should fill the office of the vice president if the vice president becomes acting president for the long term. But I think that the main thought, which is it ought to be triggered, it ought to be clear, and that the uncertainty for the world ought to be resolved quite quickly, is a good idea. And I think they showed a lot of foresight in that regard.
And finally, can you imagine the process, now that you understand it well, whether it would unfold the way it should in our current political environment? And again, that's speculation, but given all the issues people watch, polarization and some of the difficulties of Congress dealing with basic issues, can you foresee this working right now smoothly? Or do you imagine there would be a lot of problems if this moved forward?
I don't think any step would be uncontroversial, but I think that the people who had the law on their side and had thought this through, and who had the interests of the country and the rule of law at heart, could just point to this provision saying, look, this was an anticipated situation, and we're following those rules. There's an interesting fact, which is a key player who is not mentioned anywhere is the White House Chief of Staff. Obviously, that person is critical, has over time, as you know from your own work, become a critical figure in both executing the president's policies and in assessing the president's capacities. But that person is not given any kind of formal role or even mentioned in this process. In 1967, the White House staff was much smaller, and they didn't really have people with these formal titles. And as you mentioned earlier, the technology, you could be in the middle of a, a cyber attack in which responses are needed immediately, even while all these kinds of discussions are going on. So, and in fact, it could be that the inability is assessed by the way someone in the president's office is trying to respond to a crisis. It could be so clearly inappropriate for the circumstance that that is what triggers this kind of examination. So at the end of the day, you can think of our report as a kind of a tabletop exercise. We literally sat there and went through every provision and said, how would this actually operate? What does the legislative history say? What have all the scholars said? What are the best alternative readings of the text? What's the best reading or the one that makes the most sense in light of the intention of the framers? And that was designed to so that somebody who's got to make this determination can just look and say, okay, here's one view. I'll say one other thing, Julian, before mm-hmm. before we end. You know, some people have written these commentaries which say things like, if you voted for the president knowing who he is, there's no role for the 25th Amendment. You know, that can't be true. You know, this made it possible that if someone's unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office once they become president, in some important sense, the 25th Amendment creates a constant duty of monitoring, because there is a remedy if it turns out that he's unable.
Again, our guest today was Professor Harold Koh of the Yale Law School, University Law School. And I want to recommend that everyone takes a look at this. Again, it's through the Yale Law School Rule of Law Clinic. It's called, the study's called The 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution, a Reader's Guide. It's available online. It really is a nonpartisan but very substantive analysis of this process. And it's a real public service that you were able to put this together for us. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Julian. It's my pleasure.
And that's it for our episode. Thanks again, and we'll be back soon. Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.